By the way, I failed to tell you that in the fellowship hall afterwards for the fathers, Linda had a cookie cake made that had an inscription for the fathers that may have disappeared by now. But you might go and see if there's a piece or two left. And please don't scrape off the icing that says Happy Father's Day. All right. Last week, we gave a brief overview of the book of Judges in the Bible. And we noted that really when we go to the book of Judges, that is sort of it's kind of out of the way in our normal Bible reading. We probably prefer Romans or Matthew or the Psalms. But to get into Judges, I think sometimes we feel like, well, that's really getting in the weeds. And there's some justification for that. We said that while at the beginning of the book of Judges, there were some good intentions reflected, and there's some military victory, and there's some geographic gains on the part of the Hebrew people, the mood of the book degenerates as you go further in. And in the end, you have, as we said, despicable people doing deplorable things. Or perhaps it's deplorable people doing despicable things, but in either case, it's not pretty. Even the heroes in this book, the judges, are more anti-heroes than they are heroes. And the message of the book is that without godly leaders, without good, strong leaders, human nature drives society towards anarchy. And we noted the book by William Golding, Lord of the Flies, as an illustration of that, and how a secular sociologist could come to that same conclusion. And where there is no leader, left to his or her own devices, individuals will determine their own self-serving morality. So throughout this book, not only do we see deplorable behavior, but their worship of God turns into a pursuit of idolatry as the Israelites borrow from their stubborn Canaanite neighbors, and the repetitive theme that we'll read throughout this book is there was no king in the land, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And that's perhaps the main point of the book, that God really, in the end, has no superstars. Even people that we tend to put on pedestals are subject to sin and moral collapse. There are no heroes, only broken people. But the hope is, the hope is not that these great Hebrew leaders, but in the one to whom these great Hebrew leaders point. A champion that was perfect in every way. And he not only would fight to save his people, but he himself would die in so doing. And of course, I'm talking about our Lord Jesus Christ. So today, we dive in and we look at the first chapter of the book of Judges, and the themes stick out right from the outset. As we're going to look at these passages, what we're going to find in these 13 verses is a description of the possessing of the land that God had given to the Hebrews. Now, the question always arises, why all the bloodshed? Why all the killing? Have you ever asked yourself that? And when you're speaking to people who aren't particularly sympathetic to the Christian cause, one of the things that the discussion always comes to is, how come God had all those people killed? Well, the answer isn't very satisfying if we're insisting on holding God to our standard of morality, given our very sketchy understanding of those people who those people are and what they've done. And the short answer is, in the end, we don't know and likely couldn't understand the mind of God on this, why there is so much killing. But we still scratch our head and we ask that question, and I would tell you it is not a question to shy away from. It is a question to embrace and a fair question. Now, an earlier piece of Judges gives us at least a clue to part of the answer to this difficult question. And that's in Judges chapter 1 from verses 4 to 7. This is what we read in those verses. Then Judah went up, and the Lord gave the Canaanites and the Perizzites into their hand, and they defeated 10,000 of them at Bezek. They found Adonai Bezek at Bezek. That name, incidentally, Adonai Bezek, simply means the Lord of Bezek or the leader of Bezek. And they fought against him, and they defeated the Canaanites and the Perizzites. Adonai Bezek fled, but they pursued him, and they caught him, and they cut off his thumbs and his big toes. Now, that's not very nice. And Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off used to pick up scraps under my table. As I have done, so God has repaid me. So in other words, Adonai Bezek, no friend of God, was saying, what goes around comes around. Of course, he said it in a different way. But the Canaanites were cruel and bloodthirsty people. There was a day when God saw such people and destroyed the entire human race, save Noah and his family. Even Adonai Bezek knew that his history demanded this kind of justice. He said, as I have done, so God has repaid me. And so you have an enemy of the people of God saying, yep, I deserved it. Yep, I had it coming to me. But after all, the Israelites had their share of sin as well. For that, we have no answer except undeserved mercy. It's our own story. Today, we're sitting here in church together, and I'd ask you the question, what makes us different than the, and if statistics are correct, 240 million Americans that chose or will choose not to go to church today? The difference is not that we're better than them. The difference is undeserved mercy. Not a one of us deserves or has earned God's favor. We have no idea why we enjoy God's favor and why others don't. It's not whether or not we sin, nor is it a question as to how much sin is too much sin, because even one sin separates us from God for eternity. But we had a champion. We had a champion who went up and fought for us, and the victory he won for us was at the cost of his death. And at the cross in Jerusalem, just outside the gates, God exchanged our sin for Jesus' righteousness. We don't deserve God's favor. Israel didn't deserve God's favor. And the Canaanites didn't deserve God's favor. But we thank God for our champion, Jesus Christ. Now, there's a possible second reason why there is bloodshed here. And that is this. And I think we're going to see this as we go on in the book of Judges. You know, the original plan was that the Israelites were to go up against the Canaanites some 40 years before this. They had camped in Kadesh Barnea, and God said, go up and occupy the land. They were supposed to be able to just to go up, occupy the land, and not fire a shot. And the Canaanites were prepared to walk away. and they didn't. Instead, the Israelites chose not to go up as God had asked them to, and instead they wandered in the wilderness for 40 years and brought them to this place where they had to fight in order to get the land. It was their rebellion that created the need for this bloodshed. Okay, as I said, you'll ask yourself that question for a long time, and you'll never come up with what will be a satisfying answer to you. And it's largely in part because it defies our sense of right and wrong. And so we begin to hold God to our standard of righteousness. At the very end of the day, what you can say is, when I create my own heavens and earth out of nothing, when I do that, then I can make the rules. But until that time, I'm going to have to play by God's rules. It's His universe. Okay. The 13 verses we're looking at today are divided into three sections. One has to do with some successful military campaigns. Some has to do with some failing military campaigns. And then there's a story that's sandwiched in between the two. And I want us to look at those only briefly at the military campaigns, because the text tells us that Judah, the tribe of Judah, took over the city of Jerusalem. They didn't completely wipe out all the people that were living there. They used their own judgment. It would cause them problems later on. But for the most part, they took over the city of Jerusalem. And then they made military and geographical gains in three areas that were south and southwest of Jerusalem. The hill country, which was rolling hills to the south and east of Jerusalem. The Negev, which is arid and desert land south and west of Jerusalem. And the western foothills that were... It was hilly country that sloped down into a plain that ultimately led to the Mediterranean. And then they took Hebron, where Abram and Sarah were buried, and they were making advances against a city called Debir. Three territories and three cities that they were making gains on. All great victories for them. And so we read in Judges chapter 1, 8 through 11, "The men of Judah attacked Jerusalem also and took it. They put the city to the sword and set it on fire. And after that, Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country, the Negev, and the western foothills. They advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiriath Arba, and defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, Talmai. And from there, they advanced against the people living in Debir, formerly Kiriath Sefer." So that was the first. They had some successful campaigns. But you recall what we said was that what started out as success would eventually degenerate into failure. And so they had some failing campaigns. And that's what this text does. It ends with a mixed bag of victories and defeats. And this last section begins with the Kenites, who are also called the Midianites. The Midianites would torment the Israelites for generations to come. The Midianites went up with Judah, and they fought against the Philistines. And they came against Zaphath, Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron, which are Philistine cities. And Judah was successful in the hill country. However, the people of the plains, which was west of Jerusalem, were able to fend off attacks, and the surviving inhabitants deceived, killed, and corrupted Israel for years to come. And we read that in Judges chapter 1, verses 16 through 21. "The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms," which is Jericho and not Fort Myers, "with the people of Judah to live among the inhabitants of the desert of Judah in the Negev near Arad. Then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their fellow Israelites, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath. And they totally destroyed the city. Therefore, it was called Hormah. Judah also took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron, each city with its territory. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the from the plains because they had chariots fitted with iron. As Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove it from the three sons of Anak. The Benjamites, however, did not drive out the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live with those Benjamites. Close enough. Okay. Now, if I were sitting where you were sitting right now, I would say, come on, Anderson, this is killing me. You know, my son went to a church in the greater Washington, D.C. area, and the pastor was teaching a series on Leviticus. And I asked my son one day, what did you study in church today? What did the pastor preach on? And he said the pastor preached on bodily discharges. I know this is military campaigns, and so this, I mean, it seems a little dry, but what we're coming to is a part that I think you're going to find interesting. I know I did. And it has nothing to do with bodily discharges. Sandwiched between those two somewhat sterile recounting of military successes and failures comes a story of military successes and failures, or a historical military leader, and a bit of just a bit of romance, at least romance in the 1000 BC way. Caleb first appeared early on in the desert crossing. While they were at Kadesh Barnea, God told the people of Israel to go up and take the land of Canaan, the promised land. They were to go up and they were just to occupy it. The people in the land had said, our hearts had become as water. We were ready to give up and let you have our property. And so the people of Israel weren't too sure about this. And so they said, well, what we really want is we want to send up some spies to kind of check out the land. And then we'll know if we should go up or not. And so they chose 12 spies. The 12 spies were identified because each tribe, there were 12 tribes, each tribe sent up one representative from each tribe to be the spy. The spy for the tribe of Judah was Caleb. And the 12 tribes, the 12 spies came back. And they came back with this report. It's in Numbers chapter 13, verse 23. And they came to the valley of Eshcol and cut down from there a branch with a single cluster of grapes. Now, I go over to Publix, and I like it when those grapes are, you know, like big. And you get a bag of those grapes, and you wash them off, and then you pop them in your mouth. I'm loving that. I'm thinking that's what I'm going to have for lunch today. But this is what happened. They found a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two of them. That's some serious grape right there. And they brought some pomegranates and figs. The place was verdant. It was fertile, and they had great crops, things that these people could live with and enjoy. But in Numbers chapter 13, verse 30, after the people had rebelled and said, no, we shouldn't go up against the land because there's giants there, it says in Numbers 13, 30, but Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and occupy it, for we are well able to overcome it. 10 spies had said, we can never do that. Caleb and Joshua said, let's go now. And because he, together with Joshua, took that position in that entire generation of people, some 2 million people, only Joshua and Caleb would get into the promised land. And Moses promised to Caleb and his family, Hebron as a bonus. They just took over Hebron. And in these verses, Hebron is given to Caleb and his family. But there's still one more city that needed realigning, and that was Debir. And Caleb anticipates a very tough conflict, so he promises the hand of his daughter to the one who would go up and defeat the enemy. And one came forward, and his name was Othniel. He was a relative of Caleb, and he takes the challenge. He's victorious, and so he gets the prize. He gets Caleb's daughter. Now, as 21st century Americans, we look at that and we say, there's all kinds of wrong with that arrangement. But let's not be too hasty to impose our cultural restrictions on an incident in a country that's half a world away and was 3,000 plus years ago. What they did was culturally appropriate, and it would happen again in a few more years. Saul, as king, would offer his daughter to one who would beat Goliath. David beat Goliath, and he got to marry Michael. So Michael got to marry a king, King David. And not only that, but David got to marry a king's daughter. That worked out pretty good for him. And so there's a couple of things that I want to point out about this this arrangement. First of all, this arrangement, this promise of Aksa, who was Caleb's daughter, to the one who would defeat the enemy, that arrangement ensured that Caleb's daughter would marry a great champion and a leader. Othniel was a judge over Israel. He was a great leader. And so Aksa, the daughter, got to marry a great leader. Now, I want to draw a comparison for just a moment to something 2,600 years later. Robert E. Lee was the general of the Southern Confederacy. Robert E. Lee had four daughters. And do you know that none of his four daughters ever married? Some psychologists suggest that women look for their father in the man that they marry. I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that these four daughters of Robert E. Lee ended up not ever marrying, for good or for bad. Maybe there's nobody in the Confederacy worth it. If you're from south of the Mason-Dixon line, I'm sorry. My wife is from Macon, so I can't say that too often. But think about this. How old was Aksa, this lady? Caleb was a mature adult and leader of the tribe of Benjamin at Kadesh Barnea. How long ago had Kadesh Barnea occurred? Figure maybe 40 years before. So now we're 40 years later, and Caleb must have been at least 25 years old at the time. So that means that Caleb was about 65 years old, plus or minus. Somebody has suggested that Caleb was as old as 90 plus years old at this time. And Aksa was still an unmarried daughter with a father who was between 65 and 90 years old. That would mean that she was up in years and in a culture where being single was considered a curse from God. Caleb got his daughter hitched. And so Othniel was given land in the arid, desert-like Negev from Caleb. And on a day when they, that is Othniel and Aksa, were visiting Caleb, maybe it was Father's Day, Aksa asked for a blessing. She asked for a blessing of her father Caleb. She wanted the rights to water. Well, after all, they had been given land in the Negev. The Negev was desert. I mean foreboding desert. And they went back to Caleb, and Aksa said, "Hey, Dad, it's kind of dry down here. How about some water? You got any land that has some water that we can have?" And so he gave it to them. And from that, they enjoyed the full blessing of the promised land. And this is where we read that story. It's Judges 1, verses 12 through 15. And Caleb said, I will give my daughter Aksa in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Debir, Kiriath Sefer. Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksa to him in marriage. One day, when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, what can I do for you? She replied, give me a blessing. Since you have set me in the land of the Negev, give me also springs of water. And Caleb gave her the upper springs and lower springs. And that's the story. Caleb was a great leader of God's people. He was a generous man, and he'll be mentioned elsewhere in Scripture, but this is it for the book of Judges. He appears not himself as a judge, but as a great leader in the book that led to Israel taking the land of Canaan. So that's a lot of history, and maybe it was just a trifle, dare I use the word boring to you, but what do we learn? I want to suggest a few things to you. First of all, the conquering of Canaan approximates our own battle with sin. I know that you've said in the past, nobody's perfect. And generally we use that when we're finding a reason why we failed at something. In some ways, the conquering and the battles with the Canaanites is a metaphor and descriptive of our battle with our own sin natures and its failures. There was an ebb and flow to the Battle of Canaan. Great victories like Jericho, Hebron, Debir, but then heartbreaking defeats like that on the plain against the iron chariots and Jerusalem, where the Jebusites would play havoc for centuries. So also with the battle with the residual sin nature. The Bible teaches that when we become believers in Jesus Christ, we receive a new nature, and the old nature dies. There's a commentator by the name of Dale Ralph Davis. And Dr. Davis said this with regard to the book of Judges. He said, the Jebusites were dead, they just wouldn't lie down. So also with our sin nature. It's dead, but it doesn't lie down. The Bible says in Galatians 2:20, I've been crucified with Christ. It's no longer I who live, but it's Christ who lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave his life for me. We have a new nature. Our old nature is dead, but it doesn't lie down. So even the Apostle Paul says, for I do not understand my own actions. I do not do what I want, but I do the very thing that I hate. That's from the Apostle Paul. And from such passages, I draw great comfort. Because I, like Paul, do not understand my own actions. I do not do what I want to do, but oftentimes I do the very thing that I hate. There's a picture of that in Israel as they are fighting against the Canaanites. The ebb and flow of their conquest was the ebb and flow of our conquest over sin. Okay, there's a second thing I think we learned from here, and that is that the marriage metaphor is a big deal. I'm coming up, I can't match 69 years. I was just a pup when all that was happening. But I've been married, it'll be 42 years in a week. And that is a big deal. The whole marriage metaphor, it's a big deal. Caleb offered the hand of his daughter Aksa as a bribe to a champion who would fight the enemy and win. And marriage is used throughout the scriptures to relate to us the nature of the relationship of Jesus Christ to the church. So we read, for instance, in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 25, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her." Ephesians 5:28. "In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes it and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church." John the Baptist extends the metaphor. John the Baptist says, "The one who has the bride is the bridegroom." And he's speaking of Jesus as being the bridegroom who stands and hears him. And then in Revelation chapter 19 and verse 9, John writes this, "And the angel said to me, write this, 'Blessed are those who are invited to the marriage supper of the Lamb.' And he said to me, 'These are the true words of God.'" So the marriage relationship is a picture of how Christ relates to the church. And that is a major reason why God gave the institution of marriage to man, to illustrate his love for his people. And so when Othniel stands up and he says, "I will fight for God's people," and then he wins, his prize is the bride. And that foreshadows a day when the Lord Jesus would stand up and fight to the death for his bride, the church, his people. He suffered and went to the wall, giving himself up for her. It's such a good metaphor. And finally, I think there's a third takeaway in this passage, and that is that Achsa was an extraordinary person, and she is inspirational in many ways, but at least in this regard, she is like Jacob, who is monumental in the Bible. Jacob's transformative moment in his life is when he grabs hold of a man and wrestles with him and says, "I will not let you go until you bless me." And so Achsa, wanting all the benefits of the land of milk and honey, Canaan, itself a metaphor for heaven, Achsa says to Caleb, "Give me a blessing." She wanted that blessing. She wanted that fullness of life. What was she looking for? She was looking for water. Life-giving water. I'm reminded of Jesus standing up and silencing a crowd and saying, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." She is looking for living water to bring and sustain life, and holding on to her Father, seeking a blessing. So it is that we hang on to the Father and beg him for a blessing. Now we'll meet Othniel again. Caleb is pretty much finished in the book of Judges. Achsa is done in the book of Judges. But the battle for the land and for freedom from the corrupting influences of the idolatry of the Canaanites continues. Would you pray with me? God, we read back into a culture that existed 3,000 plus years ago, and